From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Today's new jobs report finds that the U.S. actually added 2.5 million jobs in May. At the Rose Garden this morning, President Trump praised the economy.
Today is probably, if you think of it, the greatest comeback in American history. But it's not going to stop here. It's going to keep going.
The president is now pushing for all states to reopen. And even though the unemployment rate dropped to just over 13% last month, there are still more than 37 million people claiming unemployment benefits. NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley joins us now. And Scott, this report actually stunned many economists. The president, of course, sees this as a turning point. Could it actually be one?
It's certainly a turning point. We've gone from losing jobs for a couple of months to now gaining jobs in May. So that is a turning point. But it's important to keep some perspective here. In March and April, the country lost more than 22 million jobs. In May, we regained about 11% of those. That's absolutely better than losing more, but we're still in a pretty deep hole here. That unemployment rate of 13.3%, that's still well above the worst rate we saw at any time during the Great Recession after the financial collapse.
Let's talk a little bit about what happened in May to bring about these numbers.
Yeah, I think what happened is businesses around the country began reopening, and that happened faster than I think forecasters were expecting. The real surprise here is not that the economy started adding jobs again. I think most people expected that to happen in June. It just happened a month earlier than most of the economists had been expecting. We knew the pace of pandemic layoffs had been slowing in recent weeks, and we had been looking at all the sort of weekly data for any sign of jobs actually being added. We hadn't really seen that signal yet in things like the weekly unemployment claims or the number of people who are continuing to collect unemployment. Bear in mind that even with this positive news about May jobs, more than 37 million people are either collecting unemployment or in the line for it.
We should stress that, as you mentioned, there are still millions of people out of work, as you said. What industries, though, are we actually seeing a comeback?
A lot of the ones that were hardest hit when we voluntarily locked down the economy in a sort of desperate bid to slow the spread of the pandemic, that is bars and restaurants, retail stores, also construction, manufacturing, and healthcare, which is usually pretty recession-proof, but even healthcare lost jobs in April as a lot of doctors and dentists closed their offices for anything but emergencies. So those have all seen a comeback, although the gains have not by any means erased the job losses that we saw in March and April. There are other industries that continue to lose jobs. Air travel lost another 50,000 jobs in May on top of the jobs that were lost in April. And importantly, state and local government lost more than 500,000 jobs in May. That's on top of nearly 1 million jobs that local governments lost in April. That's a sign that there's kind of a delayed effect on local government budgets as the rest of the economy turns south. And unless the federal government comes through with some help for state and local governments, we could see more job losses there going forward.
This morning, the president waved off questions from journalists about the unemployment figures for Black and Asian Americans today. What do these numbers tell us about unemployment in these communities of color?
Well, certainly African Americans and Latinos in particular still face a challenging job picture. Their unemployment rates were higher than the national average before the pandemic, and they're higher now as well. The jobless rate for African Americans actually ticked up a little bit in May, even as the overall number was coming down. Now, that could be some statistical noise. The unemployment rate among African Americans bounces around a little bit just with some sampling error. But we do know that a great number of African Americans who are still working are holding those kind of frontline essential jobs that also put them at greater risk of infection. So that's another thing to keep in mind. We did see a drop last month in Latino unemployment. Latinos are concentrated in some of the industries that did make a partial recovery, like food service and construction. But again, the jobless rate for Latinos is above that for both African Americans and whites. All this is just a sign of the kind of structural inequality that has been persistent in this country and which sadly is sort of fueling some of the demonstration that we're seeing around the country.
That's NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley. As always, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, the demonstrations we've been seeing around the country are also playing out on social media. Let's bring in Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy.
And there's just so much to talk about with you, but let's start with something that's trending today. Hashtag He's75. This is after police in Buffalo, New York, pushed an older man to the ground during a protest yesterday. Listen. He's bleeding out of his ears. They're saying, get a medic. A Buffalo police spokesman told CNN that two officers have been suspended because of that incident, and the man is in the hospital in serious but stable condition. What do we know about what happened here, and what has the reaction been like online?
The reason we know what happened is because NPR station WBFO shared video of the old senior being pushed to the ground. Earlier, yesterday evening, the police spokesman said that one person was injured when he tripped and fell. It became very clear from the video that there was no tripping, although there was some falling, and people were incensed, which is why He's 75 trended. Results of that immediately. When that video was out, this is the power of video on social, I would say. The man is now in a stable condition. Two officers have been suspended without pay. Buffalo Police Commissioner has asked for an immediate investigation. Let me give you a little sense of the response and the reaction on Twitter. Peter Morley says the other officers just left him on the sidewalk bleeding after he was pushed and shoved by Buffalo police officers. He's 75. Is this how far our country has fallen? Remarkably, though, Jeremy, not everybody was saying the same thing. In the defense of the police, many people were saying, well, the gentleman should not have been near a police line. What do you expect? You would get pushed. He's old enough to know better. Stay home if you don't want to be facing the police. So there's a split conversation. Even though we see the video, we see the man on the ground, and we hear his head hitting the ground as well.
We've also seen celebrities speaking up about George Floyd's death. Here's Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex, in a virtual graduation speech for the Immaculate Heart High School in Los Angeles. She called events in the country devastating.
The only wrong thing to say is to say nothing. George Floyd's life mattered, and Breonna Taylor's life mattered, and Philando Castile's life mattered, and Tamir Rice's life mattered. And so did so many other people whose names we know and whose names we do not know.
Now, Meghan Markle has been open about some of the racism she has faced in her life, but how are celebrities like her being viewed for talking about race?
I call this the celebrity dilemma because you're criticized if you don't speak out. You're criticized when you do. For instance, reaction to Meghan Markle's video was both positive and negative. People were saying, you're not really black. You're making George Floyd's death about yourself. You're attention seeking. So it's really difficult for celebrities to get it just right because they're using their celebrity platform. And then some people are pushing back and they don't like them for using that platform.
Now, one of the things that I saw this week, and I'm sure you saw it, was the blackout on Tuesday of social media where everybody was just posting just a black square on Instagram or on Facebook, and usually with the hashtag Blackout Tuesday, people just voicing their solidarity with victims of police violence and with the protesters. What are people saying about that whole exercise and how it worked?
So the social campaign, the idea was very laudable. It was to support the Black Lives Matter organization. There were a couple of practical issues that surfaced almost immediately. If people were posting a black square using the hashtag Black Lives Matter, it meant that very important, more practical information was literally buried under black squares. So supporters of the Black Lives Matter movement said, take down your squares, take down your posts, and then repost it using the actual hashtag for the campaign, which is Blackout Tuesday. That's one practical problem. The second issue that came up was one of intention. So some people interpreted Blackout Tuesday as do nothing, say nothing. And Black Lives Matter supporters were saying, actually, this is the time to raise your voice, to have conversations, to use any privilege that you might have. So there was pushback about that. And then finally, a third criticism that I noticed, and this one is one of all social media campaigns, is that maybe you should be doing something more than post. Brandi Riley's tweet jumped out at me, went viral. She says, "Thank you for your Black Lives Matter graphic. May I please see a picture of your executive leadership team and company board?" Which means, I know that you're posting, I know you're supporting, thank you so much, but are you really practicing what you post?
We'll leave it at that, Femi, because that's an important point. Femi Okay, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now.
And music about police violence has also been climbing the Spotify charts this week, including This Is America by Childish Gambino. You're listening to Here and Now.
This is America. Don't got you slipping up. Look how I'm living up. Police be tripping up. Yeah, this is America. Guns in my area. I got the strap. I gotta carry 'em. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go into this.
It feels like nothing in the news these days makes any sense. So Hassan Minhaj turned to his father and his faith for answers.
He said, don't worry about the number of questions. Just worry about which questions become more clear and solidified.
Comedian Hassan Minhaj on how his spirituality is getting him through. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Three men are facing terrorism-related charges in Nevada after allegedly planning to incite violence at protests over the death of George Floyd. Federal prosecutors say the men are connected to the Boogaloo movement, associated with far-right extremists. This is just one example of a disturbing trend at peaceful demonstrations across the country. Alex Goldenberg has a new report out this week on extremists and protesters, and he's lead intelligence analyst with the Network Contagion Research Institute. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Tanya.
Your research began even before this latest wave of protests over systemic racism, and you and others have found that extremists are also inserting themselves in and also some of the coronavirus reopening protests. Who are these groups that you have been tracking?
So our recent report outlines certain extremist subgroups coalescing all over social media into what we describe as the militia sphere. The groups that we paid particular attention to were groups like the Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, and then the Boogaloo movement as well. And we found that the militia sphere has grown increasingly extreme across platforms. As the pandemic lockdowns have continued to view such lockdowns as government overreach or even a plot to justify a police state. And it's apparent that these communities have attempted to even exploit recent protests regarding the George Floyd incident. And we've seen enthusiasts from the Boogaloo movement in particular who've been donning Hawaiian shirts at over 40 protests in the past week. And they've even adopted George Floyd as a symbolic martyr.
Yeah, so you're giving us a bit of a sense of how widespread these groups are, but do you have numbers? And this is interesting, this idea of malicious fear.
So we have seen Boogaloo chatter in particular doubling on social media platforms like Reddit, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And to give you a sense of the numbers, according to the Tech Transparency Project, there are over 140 Facebook groups connected to the Boogaloo movement, and some of these groups boast tens of thousands of followers.
Now they're out in the streets. You gave a number of the projected number of those who are infiltrating these protests, like the George Floyd protests, as well as coronavirus reopening protests. Is there any sense of what they want and what they're asking for, what the purpose of infiltrating these protests are?
So, at first, earlier this year, many of the platforms that we tracked, the term Boogaloo was initially used to describe an uprising against a tyrannical government in response to a perceived threat of widespread gun confiscation. We first saw them in person, actually, at the Richmond, Virginia rallies earlier this year. But as we've outlined in our recent report, the animus has quickly shifted from theme to theme And this really exemplifies the flexibility of this particular ideology. They're seeking to co-opt these recent protest movements to further their own objective, and the objective is to promote sedition and civil war.
Attorney General William Barr said yesterday that he thinks it's mostly outside actors starting violence at these protests. Let's listen.
In many places, it appears the violence is planned, organized, and driven by anarchic and left extremist groups, far left extremist groups, using Antifa-like tactics, many of whom travel from outside the state to promote the violence.
Barr is talking about far left extremists, but how much evidence is there to his point? How much are we seeing far left extremists stoking violence as well, as far as you can tell from your research?
Well, currently, researching far-left violence is on our radar and most definitely in line with the mission of NCRI, as the organization seeks to chart extremism on all political polls. We currently have some preliminary data on the nature of more extreme-leaning left-wing communities, but we are still very much in the preliminary stages. However, on Wednesday, federal prosecutors in Nevada charged three Boogaloo enthusiasts with terrorism offenses for plotting to use Molotov cocktails and explosives to incite violence on George Floyd protests. And this isn't an isolated example of Boogaloo adherents apprehended by police at recent protests. One young man from Denver, Colorado, a self-described Boogaloo boy just last week, was arrested near a protest with numerous weapons, including several assault rifles. And in Tennessee, a man who was armed with an AR-15 was arrested at a protest, who had earlier posted about the Boogaloo on social media.
As you mentioned, these groups are mobilizing online and then going out into these protests. What do you think can be done and needs to be done to stop this type of thing from happening?
I believe that social media companies need to be more proactive in identifying these groups once they cross the line and begin inciting violence and organizing on highly politically volatile events to hijack the media narrative. And I think some good steps have been taken. Reddit just recently shut down several Boogaloo-related subreddits for inciting and glorifying violence, and that's a step in the right direction. And also, from my understanding, Facebook is now making it more difficult for users to find groups associated with the term Boogaloo.
That's Alex Goldenberg. He is with the Network Contagion Research Institute, which has a new report out on extremists inserting themselves into protests. We will post a link at hereandnow.org. Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tanya. Happy to be here.
Many of you may remember watching a video from late May taken in Central Park. It was a white woman threatening a black man who was bird watching. The man asked her to leash her dog in an area where that was mandated. The woman purposely called out the man's race in a phone call to police, and now this incident has sparked lots of action online. Julie Grant from the Allegheny Front reports on a new social media trend called #BlackBirdersWeek.
Monique Pipkin studies birds for the PhD she's working on at Cornell University. So when she saw a call for black birders to post a bird photo, she chose the chipping sparrow.
That's the animal I learned kind of how to bird with. And they're these tiny little sparrows who have this lovely trill song, so it's a single note repeated.
Chuita Martinez, a PhD student at University of Louisiana, helped organize #BlackBirdersWeek on Twitter and Instagram. She tweeted the northern mockingbird.
Most people sometimes find them annoying. I think they're really cool.
It was one of a handful of photos she posted of what she calls backyard birds.
Just to show everyone out there, especially black birders that are just beginning, you can probably find these birds or see them around very easily.
Event co-organizer Tyke James says as a kid in Philadelphia, his friends couldn't understand why he would get up early on weekends to go bird watching. But he remembers the thrill of seeing a bird he'd studied in a book out in nature.
And I see a belted kingfish or a female sitting on a cattail, then swoops across Cobbs Creek and, you know, makes that call. That, you know, it's always going to be etched in my mind. And I was just so present in that moment that something that was on paper turned into something real.
But James wasn't surprised by the video in Central Park of a white woman calling the police on a black birder.
When I first saw it, honestly, it was just another video in the long list of videos of white people entitlement weaponizing police brutality to manage an inconvenience in their life that involves a person of color.
James says Black Birders Week was conceived when a group called Black AF in STEM was talking online about it.
I initially didn't even watch the whole video because I knew exactly how it was going to end. I was wrong. It led into Black Birders Week.
The week has included Black Birders posting photos of themselves in nature, a Twitter chat called Ask a Black Birder, a day to highlight female birders, and a live discussion called Birding While Black on Facebook, hosted by the National Audubon Society, where James works. Chuita Martinez is amazed at how much attention they're getting.
I could never have imagined this. I don't think any of us could have. This was something that was needed, and really the support means everything to all of us.
Most images of birders and others in nature online are older white people and children. Martinez hopes Black Birders Week will help normalize images of black people in the outdoors. She says for a black woman, getting ready to go out birding can take a lot of effort.
I have to look like a birder, 100%. I make sure I have either a field guide in my hand of birds, just so people can see that I'm just here to bird. I'm not here to do anything else.
Martinez remembers being purposely splashed by a passing truck, and others say they mostly bird in urban areas and with white friends to avoid confrontation with people who might feel uncomfortable with a black birder. Monique Pipkin says she's only been able to go birding with other black people once in her life.
Just being able to see all of the amazing black naturalists, black biologists out there, or just black birders, or anyone who's spending time in nature is, I don't know how to say it, just besides it's affirming and it's exhilarating and it's really comforting.
And honestly, we didn't pick our moment, but we are rising to the occasion.
Tyke James says the group effort to quickly put together Black Birders Week has meant a lot of long nights. He hopes it sets a precedent for future generations, not just that everyone has a place outdoors, but also that they can work together toward positive change.
I haven't had something in my life that has been so fulfilling and that I can put so much of my energy into and get so much joy out of it. We were talking on one of the calls that we were just like, I am exhausted, but I will not stop smiling.
For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
Across the nation, monuments to the Confederacy are coming down. In Alexandria, Virginia, Birmingham, Alabama, and Tampa, Florida, statues are being trucked away and Confederate flags lowered in response to mass protests in the wake of the death of George Floyd. But perhaps the most notorious monument to be designated for removal so far is the six-story statue of Robert E. Lee in Richmond, Virginia. And for more, we have with us Roberto Roldan. He's been covering this story for NPR member station VPM in Richmond. And Roberto, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Yes. So yesterday, Governor Northam announced Virginia will remove the statue of Robert E. Lee as soon as possible and said that Richmond is no longer the capital of the Confederacy. What's been the response been there?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask, right? So Richmond has until recently been a majority African-American city and a strongly Democratic city. Many residents, and especially the thousands of protesters who've been out in the streets, have wanted to see these monuments taken down for a while. And, you know, you have some vocal opposition from pro-Confederacy groups, but from my reporting on this, I think the majority of Richmonders are supportive of taking down the monuments, or at the very least, not opposed to it.
Yeah, as you mentioned, this has been a discussion for a long time. There have been other calls to do this after the Charleston, South Carolina church shooting, for example, or Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. The other side of this is that we're reading that Confederate history groups don't want to see their statues destroyed by protesters, so they'd rather remove them to keep them safe. Can you say more about this?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've seen that happen with the protest up in Alexandria, I believe, but I don't think that's the case here in Richmond. I just went through some of the Facebook pages for the Virginia Flaggers group, which is one of the big groups here, and they're calling protesters, quote, terrorists, and saying that Democrats are using the protests as an excuse to pull the monuments down. The Monument Avenue Preservation Group, which is another pro-Confederacy group, has a number of petitions directed at President Donald Trump, asking him to step in and stop the removal of the statues here. So I'm not really hearing a whole lot of folks in Richmond saying, let's take them down, you know, preventatively.
Yeah. So, of course, the Robert E. Lee statue is the most iconic statue of the Confederacy. But there are others. In July, the city council plans to vote whether to remove them all. What can you tell us about that? Is that a real possibility?
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, before the protests and coronavirus happened, and we all sort of became health reporters, my beat is covering City Hall, so the mayor's office and city council. And what I can tell you is that just weeks ago, I don't think anyone would have predicted that the monuments would be coming down. City Councilman Michael Jones tried twice in the wake of Charlottesville and the death of Heather Heyer at the hands of white supremacists to put monument removal up for a vote here. Both times it failed to get a majority of Richmond City Council. But as of this morning and, you know, in the wake of the protests that have been happening since Sunday here in the city of Richmond, every member of Richmond City Council has now put out a statement saying that they will vote to take the Confederate monuments down.
That's reporter Roberto Roldan of Richmond's NPR member station VPM. Roberto, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
For the first time since March, New York City has reported a daily COVID-19 death toll of zero. That was yesterday. Zooming out, cases are still on the rise in the U.S., but at a slower rate than in April. Let's bring in Dr. Rochelle Walensky, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital and Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Doctor, welcome. And there were no new confirmed COVID-19 deaths in New York yesterday, although three people who were untested may have died from the disease. But still, when you compare that to the peak in April, when the city was losing at least 500 people to the pandemic each day, what does it tell you?
Well, first, I think we should just celebrate an extraordinary event. Given how sick people have been, how we've seen footage of morgues, it's just been, it's been a rough many weeks. And so I think we should celebrate this really extraordinary achievement. What I will say is that when you start seeing the markers of death, they happen 5, 6, 7 weeks after your intervention to prevent them. And so that's actually quite frustrating because you will have an intervention like closing everything down, like the masks, like the social distancing, and you can't see the benefit immediately. And what this tells you is all of that incredibly hard work that we did to stop everything in its tracks worked. We're seeing it today. And so I think that that's really important to recognize that the marker of yesterday is because we worked so hard in, you know, April.
Okay, so then given that timeline of 5, 6, 7 weeks, let me bring two items to your attention. Jacksonville, Florida reopened its beaches on April 17th, which was 7 weeks ago. We talked about it at the time. A lot of people were worried that that was going to mean a spike in cases. They haven't seen that. Georgia allowed many businesses to reopen 6 weeks ago. Do you think that the fact that we haven't seen significant spikes in those states means that what they have done is not catastrophic to the goal, which is to reduce the amount of cases and deaths?
Not yet. So I think that, you know, this is all, you know, one person infects two people, infects four people. So I think, you know, we are starting to see the data. We have to watch it really carefully. I think we should wait another 4 or 5 weeks for us to say this was a win. I think it's way too early to say that it's a win. If you look at the map of Florida, the cases that have been considered hotspots in Florida are along the coasts. That's also where there's more crowding along the coasts. I'm not ready to say that this was all a success and we should go back to life as normal by any stretch of the imagination. Time will tell. And certainly the day that you open the beaches, we shouldn't say 7 weeks later is when you're going to see the deaths. I mean, I think we really just need to wait.
President Trump says we shouldn't wait. In his news conference today, he's saying states that are still locked down should reopen, that schools should reopen. What are your thoughts on how that reopening can take place at this point? A lot of people are wearing masks, taking steps to lower their risk of transmitting the virus. Is there a way at this point that we can start to open things up in a different way than maybe a month ago or 6 weeks ago?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I have one of the big challenges with this is for the last 3 months, the public has heard from us all the things you can't do. And I really think now is the time to say, these are all the things you can do, and here is how to do it safely. Because what's very clear is we can't stay in our current state forever, right? And people are going to be anxious to go out and start recuperating in some normalcy of life. So the question is, how do you do that safely? And I think we need to start offering some more guidance in that space. I don't think it's public spaces, no masks, lots of crowding. I don't think that's the answer. But I do think if we had shifts or sizes of numbers of people that could be entering stores, everybody wearing masks, people in different sections of the store so that they're not all on top of each other, there should be some guidance that we can give people to sort of say, this is the safe way to re-engage in a shopping mall or in a hairdresser. And I think that that's on us, and there's statewide guidance in many different states in order to do that. And I think it's really important to do. The public wants to know that information.
Let me finally ask you, just maybe for some glimmers of hope here, is there anything you've seen when it comes to a possible vaccine or treatment in the last week or so that encourages you?
So I think that there's a lot of exciting news in vaccines. There has been in the last 2 weeks or so. The Moderna mRNA vaccine is in phase two trials. They're talking about phase three large-scale trials starting as early as July. Similarly, the AstraZeneca adenovirus vaccine is really looking to scale up, and Dr. Fauci has been very vocal that he's really quite optimistic about the timeline here. I want to be cautious and say we're going to have a vaccine by X date. But I do believe that by the fall, we'll have three or four of these vaccine options in phase three large-scale clinical trials. I always like to state something with regard to the vaccine trials. The best, quickest way to get a vaccine trial is to have a lot of disease out there, right? So you vaccinate a whole bunch of people. They all get exposed because there's so much disease out there. And then you know who got prevented, who was prevented by the vaccine of not getting disease. The problem with this summer, and it's a good problem to have, is we're really hopeful we don't have a lot of disease out there. And so, you know, probably in the fall, we are likely to see more disease, and that's really where we're going to be able to see the endpoint of some of these vaccine trials. But I do think that it's good news that these vaccine trials are enrolling in large scale or looking to by the summer, and that by the fall, and hopefully by the end of the year, we should have some efficacy data to be able to roll some of these out.
That is Dr. Rochelle Walensky, who's chief of infectious diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Doctor, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, in Russia, President Vladimir Putin has declared a state of emergency after a giant fuel spill in a remote Arctic region. Putin is angry at the slow response to the accident, which took place a week ago. Environmentalists are comparing it to the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill off the coast of Alaska. NPR's Lucian Kim reports from Moscow.
President Putin held an emergency teleconference on Wednesday after news trickled back to Moscow of an environmental catastrophe north of the Arctic Circle. Putin glared at nervous officials on a giant teleconference screen. He grilled them over their sluggish response after a fuel reservoir at a power plant collapsed and spilled more than 20,000 tons of diesel. Putin asked why local authorities only found out about the spill via social media, and he declared a state of emergency. State television showed how rescue workers had put up special booms on the contaminated river to contain the spill. But as of Friday morning, only 150 tons of oil products had been recovered. The company responsible for the accident, Norilsk Nickel, is one of Russia's largest metal producers. It plans to clear away contaminated soil and collect the toxic mix of water and fuel from the river. Alexei Knizhnikov of the World Wildlife Fund Russia says a big problem is the remoteness of the location, 1,800 miles from Moscow.
There is no roads there, so it's very difficult to bring enough storage capacity to keep this fuel. It's a huge amount.
He says the spill is comparable to the Exxon Valdez disaster 30 years ago in terms of volume, but not environmental impact, since the polluted water is unlikely to make it to the open sea.
My understanding that the main victims of this pollution will be fish in a river and lake.
Knizhnikov says that most of the diesel fuel that isn't cleaned up will simply evaporate. Greenpeace Russia is less optimistic. It says the spill will poison the delicate Arctic environment for many years to come. With global warming, the Arctic environment is changing rapidly as permafrost, the layer of soil that stays frozen throughout the year, is beginning to thaw in the summers. Norilsk Nickel says thawing permafrost may in fact have caused the diesel fuel tank to collapse in the first place. On national TV, Norilsk Nickel Vice President Sergei Dudchenko insisted the company did not try to hide the catastrophe.
He
said the local mayor knew about the situation and should have informed the governor, who answers to Putin. On Thursday, local law enforcement arrested a foreman at the power plant where the accident took place. He faces up to 5 years in prison for violating environmental protection rules. Lucian Kim, NPR News, Moscow.
During the Great Recession, payday loans, quick loans with high interest rates, surged. And now with unemployment numbers just over 13% and an unclear economic future, some experts predict a new uptick. For more on this, we're joined by Charla Rios, a researcher with the Center for Responsible Lending. Welcome.
Thank you, Tanya, and thanks to your listeners for having me.
So let's start with the 2009 financial crisis. We actually saw an uptick in borrowers taking out payday loans during that time, despite the high interest rates of those loans. Now, as the country faces record unemployment and economic uncertainty, do you anticipate this same pattern to repeat?
At CRL, we anticipate that payday lenders are going to continue to target distressed borrowers because that's what they have done best. Since the 2009 financial crisis and before that, payday lenders have marketed themselves as a quick financial fix. And it says that in their marketing. Often when you go to these websites or into a storefront, you'll see signs or advertisements for quick cash, money today, words that imply things around getting money fast, right? And all the rhetoric makes it seem like they're a safe place, but they're encouraging people to get into these debt traps with triple digit interest rates upwards to 300 or 400%. We won't see, of course, the hard data until next year. But even then, it will be on a state-by-state basis because there isn't a central place with our federal government that requires all states to report on payday lending.
Let's talk about that debt trap for a moment. What happens to people who typically take out these high interest loans? Do you have data on what happens to those that turn to payday loans during the Great Recession, for instance?
Yeah, we do. So we know that people who take out these loans will often be stuck in sort of a quicksand of consequences that lead to a debt trap that they have an extremely hard time getting out of if they're able to get out of it. The process of getting a payday loan for your listeners that are not familiar with the product is that the money is often lent without any confirmation of any ability to repay that loan. The lender gets access to that borrower's bank account. The lender collects the funds during the next payday because they have direct access to that bank account, putting them first in line to be repaid. So inevitably, the borrowers end up at their next pay period with their other bills due, and the lenders tend to flip the borrower into a new loan. And we've seen through research that the typical payday borrower nationally is trapped in 10 loans a year. Some of those long-term consequences can be really dire, thinking about bank penalty fees when your accounts are overdrawn, damaged credit that stays on your record for years, and even worse, bankruptcy. There's some research, too, that has linked the use of payday loans to worse health outcomes as well.
Some states have actually banned payday lending, arguing that they lead to people, as you mentioned, incurring this unpayable debt to high interest fees. But for those states without those bans, are there any protective or regulatory measures in place?
Yeah. So there's been a few that have been put in place. So we know, for example, one was in Wisconsin, where payday lending is operational, that the state regulator issued a statement cautioning payday lenders against increasing interest rates, fees, or costs during this COVID-19 crisis, and that failure to do so may result in a license suspension or revocation, which is a great thing that the state has done considering the harms of payday lending overall. There's also some states that have, such as California, that capped their loans at 36% for longer-term installment loan, which was a huge win. And we see bipartisan support across the nation for things such as a 36% rate cap.
You've mentioned these state-by-state interventions, but are there any federal regulations that we see on the horizon?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's one that we're keeping our eyes on, which is from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So in 2017, they did issue a rule to look at a person's ability to repay a payday loan. But it seems like based on what is being set forth by the CFPB thus far, that that rule may be rescinded, and that will result in folks who take out payday loans not looking at their ability to repay before they take out that loan. Inevitably, that results in them being stuck in that debt trap by taking out one loan, having it be repaid by another loan, and so forth.
I want to go back to what recourse people have. So with banks clamping down on loaning, what can people actually do?
Although payday marketers are marketing themselves as a quick financial fix, the reality of the situation is that more often than not, people are stuck in a debt trap that has led to bankruptcy, that has led to reborrowing, that has led to damaged credit, and to avoid that, if at all possible.
That's Charla Rios, a researcher for the Center for Responsible Lending. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.